Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 309. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about monsoons and tea plantations and lots of people as we go to Bangladesh. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. It's a slow news week, so I only have one news story for you before we go into our interview. A former flight attendant on the regional carrier Compass Airlines was sentenced to jail for setting on fire the airplane lavatory. One of the attorneys said that Eder Rojas has a narcissistic personality disorder and set the fire so he could play the role of hero by putting it out. And that was the defense attorney. For a link to that story, check out the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. I'd like to welcome back to the show Audrey Scott and Daniel Knoll of uncornermarket.com, who recently celebrated 5 years on the road and have come to talk to us about an out-of-the-way destination, Bangladesh. Audrey and Daniel, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
And I say welcome back to the show. I am one of those people who got to enjoy your descriptions of Prague since in between the time that you came on the show and talked about it, my wife and I had a chance to go there. So I appreciated you giving us some guidance from your time there. Bangladesh. I'm going to bet that the percentage of people in the U.S. where I am sitting here who can find Bangladesh on a map is relatively small.
I think you're probably very, very correct.
So why don't we tell people where it is, first of all, and then why did you go?
It's in South Asia, so it's just a little bit further east of India and a little bit west of Southeast Asia. And sort of both of those areas, actually, Bangladesh draws a little bit of influence from.
Well, and it used to be part of British India, and then after British India broke into the Muslim and the Hindu regions, it was part of Pakistan until a war with Pakistan when it split off.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, and that actually plays a pretty significant role in the way that Bangladeshis see themselves.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, some people even say that Bangladeshis sort of see their history as beginning in 1971 when that split occurred.
When it changed from East Pakistan to Bangladesh.
Correct.
Yes.
Interesting. And that was always seemed like a fairly tenuous way to carve a border anyway, which was a country with a great big country in the middle of these two pieces. I'm never sure that that was a good idea, but...
Let's just say it is what it is. And for as small as Bangladesh is, its population is actually pretty large. Do you know how many people are in Bangladesh?
I know it is one of the most populous countries, but I do not know how many people are there.
It's actually the most populous country in terms of, well, it's in terms of
densely populated, right?
Yeah.
So imagine this. I think it's somewhere between, and it's difficult to count when you get into these numbers, 150 and 160 million people in the space of roughly the state of Wisconsin.
So half the population of the U.S. in the state the size of Wisconsin.
Yes.
Nope, can't picture that at all. Wow.
if the United States had 11 billion people, it might feel like Bangladesh in a way.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, Dan one night did his numbers in terms of like how many people India would have, how many people the United States would have, how many people China would have. When you start getting your head around the numbers of people in Bangladesh, it's pretty mind-boggling. And then to go there... I mean, it's obviously the country's not perfect and it has a lot of issues, but considering the population density, how it's able to function and work, given the strain on the environment and everything else. It's actually pretty impressive.
But all those people are one of Bangladesh's strengths. Yeah. That's, in fact, why we went there. Because when we were traveling through Asia in 2007 and 2008, we had run across people who said, hey, have you been to Bangladesh? And we said, no. And they said, you really should go there because the people are great. And so that always stuck in our mind, and that's why we decided to return this year.
And were these expats of Bangladesh or just travelers who had been there?
They were travelers who had been there.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly one of the reasons a lot of people don't go there is I think when people think of Bangladesh, I think if they can conjure a picture, they're probably picturing starving children in Bangladesh. I mean, it's got a reputation as being very poor.
It's got a reputation as being very poor, and it also has, I mean, basically whenever Bangladesh hits the news, it's when there's
a cyclone or
a cyclone. Yeah, I was going to say an environmental disaster. Mm-hmm. It's a cyclone, it's a flood, it's a drought, and because of the population density, it's not just a couple hundred people, but it's usually thousands, if not millions of people who are affected. And when you actually go there, you get a different perspective of the country, of course, but even the Bangladeshis we spoke to were very sensitive of their image abroad. You know, they would say, well, whenever you hear about us on the news, it's always about a catastrophe, but there's actually a lot going on in the country that's very normal or that's very positive that no one ever hears about. And that's something that was kind of the common theme throughout our trip, mm-hmm. was trying to find these stories of regular people or of just kind of life developing and without the disasters and without the catastrophes, because those only happen unfortunately, every few years, but there's life that continues outside of that.
And how long did you spend in Bangladesh, too? Let's get that on the table here.
We spent about 5.5 weeks. Mm-hmm. And in that time, we saw 5 tourists.
Oh, wow.
So that gives you a sense of how heavily touristed the country is.
That, if you do your math, that means there were 30 million people for each of us.
That's probably some very good service.
Actually, to the point where, Dan was getting hugs at hotels.
People were very curious. Yeah. And so mm-hmm. I think in that region, a lot of people go to India. It's very colorful and everyone knows about India. And I think a lot of people think of Bangladesh as being something maybe the same. And in a way, slightly similar, but I'd say actually very different. And the people are a big aspect of that. And one of the big aspects is you go there and they're not accustomed to tourists and their curiosity comes out and they want to surround you and they ask you all sorts of questions. And if this is something interesting to you, particularly if you've traveled quite a lot, Bangladesh in that respect is terrifically satisfying.
Now, you said that one of the things that drew you to Bangladesh was the people. So mm-hmm. if people are going to Bangladesh, what do you say when you're going to Bangladesh? You should really do what or see what?
Actually, you don't really need to do or see much to get interaction with people. All you have to do is leave your hotel. I mean, literally. I mean, I can give you kind of an idea of some of the highlights of our trip, but most people land in Dhaka, the capital city, mm-hmm. which is a massive city. I mean, everyone's debating the population. It's either 15 or 20 million, but it's growing tremendously. And our advice actually is to spend as little time in the capital city as possible, because there's certain areas of the old town in Dhaka that are wonderful, where you'll go down there and you'll feel almost like rock stars. I mean, people are just so excited to see you and they're so curious and they're surrounding you and they're not trying to scam you or they're not touts or anything. They just want to be with you and ask questions.
Because you couldn't make enough money as a tout if there's only 5 tourists over a 5-week period.
Well, yeah. And also it's just that they just don't have that mentality. They're just excited mm-hmm. to see foreigners. But there's other parts of Dhaka that are just overwhelming in terms of traffic and overpopulation and everything. But what we did is we started in Dhaka and then we took a riverboat south, and it's called the Rocket Steamer, which is kind of an ironic name because it's probably one of the slowest boats on earth, I think.
But that's, in fact, one of its beauties. In fact, if you said to me, you know, what's one of the best memories that you have of Bangladesh, it's as the sun was setting, leaving the city of Dhaka and all of its sort of frenetic pace, and frankly, it smells, and leaving that for sort of cleaner, open air, and being in the front of this old, sort of rickety, but thankfully solid enough rocket steamer ship as you head down into kind of riverine Bangladesh. And you think, You know, it's into the great wide open. And this is ultimately, this is what Bangladesh is all about. It's about its rivers and what life is like on the river.
So you're heading south towards the Bay of Bengal, towards the Indian Ocean.
Yeah, yeah. Towards the Bay of Bengal, and ultimately for us, and ultimately for many people, to the Sundarbans, which is the great giant mangrove forest in the southern part of Bangladesh, which is the most popular site and also a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
Okay.
So what we did is we took the rocket steamer to a town called Khulna, and then we picked up our tour, which was a boat for 3 days that took us to the Bay of Bengal, where we went through the Sundarbans, these mangrove forests, which is also where there are supposedly 400 to 500 Bengal tigers still running wild in the forest. Unfortunately, we didn't actually see a tiger. We saw the paw prints and a few other remnants, but
we joked whether the locals actually made the paw prints with some sort of paw print on a stick. But there are tigers down there, and there are ways to see them. It's just they're sort of few and far between for kind of obvious reasons. You know, tigers don't come out to meet the people all the time.
In fact, where they do meet the people, that it doesn't often end well, but yeah.
Precisely.
Oh, yeah, actually, I think every year there's probably like 80 people who are killed by tigers in Bangladesh still to this day. But yeah, the Sundarbans is one area that's a popular tourist destination.
And before you go on from there, you did a tour. Did you arrange that locally or who did you go with?
We actually arranged it locally. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned, there's not a lot of tourists in Bangladesh. Mm-hmm. So there's a few main tour companies.
Tiger Tours, yeah. And probably Bengal Tours are the biggest ones.
We went with Tiger Tours, which was a little bit cheaper, but we arranged it locally, meaning we got there about, I think, a few days before the tour actually started, and we were able to get on it. And it ended up being a great tour because there were a couple of tourists on our trip, but it was also full of Bangladeshis on vacation, which was also a fun experience in terms of interacting with local people.
And it was nice.
So not only did you save money by arranging it locally, but also you got on more of a local tour, basically.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the quality of the tour was great in terms of the safety of the boat and also the quality of the food and everything else. And
well, and safer since you didn't see tigers, so.
Although we did have our guide with us who, let's just say, his gun looked like it was a remnant from the British Empire. I don't really think it would have done much if we had seen a tiger.
And he was the one hired to protect us.
Yeah.
And so we were on a tour on the boat for 3 days, and you can take a tour up to maybe 5 or 7 days. 3 days certainly felt sufficient. But the entire time, particularly when you go on these sort of walking tours through the forests, there's a bit of a struggle between you really want to see tigers, but you don't want to see them that close. So people are really excited to go out and see tigers at the same time. If anyone feels like there's a tiger nearby, we actually saw like cat scratch prints on a tree. And so everyone, including our guides, were really excited. At the same time, they began making noises because they thought, well, if there's really a tiger here, we want to drive it away. And so people thought, well, I want to be safe. You know, I want the tiger to go away. At the same time, I'd really like to see the tiger. So there's this sort of this draw back and forth. And that's part of the drama that gets built when you travel through the Sundarbans.
Hmm.
And the other nice thing about the Sundarbans is it's an uninhabited area. And considering the population density of Bangladesh, it's actually kind of a nice break to be in a place where there's no people for a few days. Because yeah, there are some other parts of the country tend to be a bit crazy and intense. So from there, we went to a town called Bagerhat, where there was another UNESCO site, which was a pre-Mughal mosque. And the fun part about seeing these tourist sites in Bangladesh is because there's no tourists, they're basically full of locals just going and doing their own thing. And so we were kind of the main attraction in most places that we went. It got to the point where everyone was flocking to us because they were just curious and wanted to see kind of where we were from and who we were and what we were doing. And then we spent some time in the western part of the country, which included a weekend or a couple of days in a village homestay. We had met up with an NGO that was just starting a rural tourism program with families and villages. And that was one of the best experiences of the trip.
And I loved the picture that you have on your website of the daughter of the family just clinging to you in the picture.
Yeah, I mean, that just represents the experience. And the whole family was just great. I mean, there was also the grandmother who was just lovely, who kept kind of coming and almost like petting my hair and making sure I was okay. And part of that trip also included, or part of that kind of rural tourism experience included going to a couple of village schools. Where again, you know, we entered into this school courtyard and 500 kids just come running out of the classrooms, kind of screaming towards us. You know, if you could just bottle that energy, you'd be a millionaire. And then it was also really neat going into specific villages that focused on pottery and specific villages that focused on popped rice. And you realize that these villages have been doing the same thing for hundreds of years. You can kind of see the tradition and the continuity. And the other thing is because of the population density, the cities in Bangladesh tend to be rather crazy. Mm-hmm. A lot of mayhem and noise and just commotion.
Compression,
yeah. But the villages are really rather calm and peaceful and very organized. And it's a nice contrast. So my suggestion is for anyone who's going to Bangladesh, make sure they spend time in the countryside.
That's where the hope is, yeah. I think. In fact, there are a lot of aid workers in Bangladesh, obviously. And if you talk to them, the sort of main theme that will, you know, rise to the top in discussions with them is the hope is in the villages. Hmm. You know, less compression there, you get a chance to meet people. That's where different types of technologies and solutions and things are like that are emerging in Bangladesh. I mean, the country has to manage a population of 150 to 160 million people. So to the extent that it gets managed in creative ways in the countryside. Not to mention the countryside's really beautiful, and that's the place where you'll have really personal experiences.
As well as food is the best.
Okay. And typically in a country like this, as people move into the city, they're somewhat breaking with their roots in the village. So you're probably a little more connected to the culture, I would think, in the village.
Yeah, you're more connected to the culture and you just have a closer connection with family. Mm-hmm. The families still live in courtyard settings, so multiple generations in one courtyard, multiple generations as well as aunts and uncles and cousins. So it's a very warm and very close family situation when you're in the villages. And also they know how to use everything and anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of universal, is anytime you go into the villages, they know how to use every single root and every single item that in cities tend to be thrown out. They're very resourceful.
Now, language, you're obviously in a place that used to be part of the British Raj. Is there still a lot of English?
What we've heard is there's actually less English now than there used to be.
Okay.
So we often were able to find English speakers, but there's a lot of very basic English, meaning that people know how to ask your name, ask where you're from, and that kind of maxes out their language skills.
That's as far as I get in this podcast sometimes also. So.
Well, then, yeah, then you fit right in. But often we would find, especially in towns that had universities, we'd find students or we'd find other people with higher levels of English who were just very excited to use it. I mean, one of the towns that we didn't really spend a lot of time in, but again, kind of represented this hope or this optimism, was a town called Rajshahi, and it's a big university town. It's very close to the border with India, and it actually has the Ganges River running through it. And we just went down by the river and at dusk, you know, to kind of see what was going on, and we were just swarmed by university students. And their questions and their level of English was just really, really impressive. And so that's the thing, is you're not going to find English like that everywhere, but especially in the towns, you'll find a few people. And those people tend to find you just because they want to practice and they're curious.
Mm-hmm. And then what else did you do on your itinerary, or what else would you recommend?
There are a number of towns and villages in the northwestern part of the country that actually touch on the country's kind of Hindu past. So there are a number of Hindu temples in places and towns like Puthia. So if you get yourself acquainted with a map of Bangladesh. And then there are a number of villages north of there that we didn't go to that also have various collections of Hindu temples. And then in a town called Paharpur, there's another UNESCO World Heritage Site that is actually the birthplace of Tantric Buddhism. Mm-hmm. Really surprising. You're talking about Bangladesh, which is a country that's something like 95% Muslim. Right. And it actually houses the birthplace of Tantric Buddhism. So it's like this offshoot of Hinayana Buddhism. There's a rather large complex there whose architecture is known to have influenced architecture of Buddhist temples throughout places in Southeast Asia. I think it houses, or it did house at one time, 177 monastic dormitories or
kind of students, because it was kind of like a university monastery, and it was basically under dirt for hundreds of years. It's from the 8th century, and it was under dirt for hundreds of years, and then it was recently discovered. But that's actually one of the interesting things with Bangladesh is people don't realize its layers of history. They associate it with just being a Muslim country, but it actually has a very strong Hindu and also Buddhist past.
Well, even you were talking about the Muslim mosque that was pre-Mughal, and we didn't really stop at the time and say what that meant, but you're really saying that this was a mosque before the Muslim invasion that conquered much of what is now India.
Right, and so it predates all of that architecture that you might see in northern India that we have come to associate with places like Delhi and Agra, for example. Mm-hmm. And we made the mistake on our blog of calling that mosque a Mughal mosque. And on more than one occasion, we met people who said, I read your blog, and by the way, that is not a Mughal mosque. That is, in fact, a pre-Mughal mosque. So this is the interesting thing about Bangladesh. Not a lot of people there, but there are a number of people who are very excited about what Bangladesh has to offer. And I think when more people go there, more resources will be used to kind of unearth the history that's in that country. And I think when we were there, we spoke to people who were interested in uncovering Silk Road routes or Silk Route offshoots that might have made their way down into Bangladesh and through to the Bay of Bengal, and ways of connecting it with Greater Asia. Just because so much of the history has been buried in the, ironically, in the last 40 years, that's been primarily Muslim and is focused on East Pakistan and the break with Pakistan in 1971. And I think with more people going there, I think there's going to be more attention and more resources, and there's probably going to be more discoveries. And Bangladesh will become one of these sites that more people will go to, and people will say, this was a place that was once undiscovered.
You did have at least one other trip that you mentioned on your blog that sounded very interesting as you were bicycling through the tea plantations.
Yeah, I was actually just going to mention that when you had asked the previous question about other places. There's a town in the northeastern part of the country called Srimangal, and the town itself is kind of a small town, and there's not a lot going on there.
A small town with only like 2 million
people. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I understand, yeah. We were just in China and literally had someone say to us that they really liked living in Xi'an, China, because it had more of a small town feel than Beijing. and it is an 8 million person city, so it's literally the size of Los Angeles or New York City, and yet they were describing it as a small town. So I understood what you meant when you said that.
Yeah, now imagine bicycling through downtown New York or Los Angeles, and that's what bicycling through Srimangal in northeastern Bangladesh is like. But what's nice there is a lot of tea plantations. You can do some really terrific tea tasting. There's also something called seven-layer tea, which has been reproduced in various cafes throughout the area. But there's one guy who serves the original seven-layer tea, and it's absolutely worth seeking out. One for the visual, and then also for the taste. It's like no other tea that you've tasted.
Before you go past seven-layer tea, we can't let you go that quickly without describing it. I can picture seven-layer dip. I've had that. Is a seven-layer tea, I can literally see the different types of liquid in the glass, or what are you describing?
Yeah. It's layers of...
It's like a parfait.
A white?
Yeah,
yes.
But it's liquid. I mean,
And nobody doesn't like parfait.
But some people might not like seven-layer tea. But if you are into tea and you're into various types of herbs and spices and things like that, seven-layer tea is where it's at. And so there's like layers of tan and white and maroons, and it all sits there vaguely suspended. And then when you taste it, you're thinking, all right, I'm tasting a little bit of tea. I know there's some cream in here. There's probably some lemon. There's probably some asafoetida, which is a South Asian spice some people might know that has sort of a funny scent to it. There's maybe a little bit of cardamom. We tried breaking it down, did a little bit of research on it. This guy's really secretive about it, but it's definitely one of those experiences worth seeking out.
And in addition to that, just biking around the tea plantations, it's just a really nice experience because you're in nature, it's green, there's not a lot of people. After a while, you're kind of looking for those experiences where there's not people everywhere, or there's just not a lot of population density. And the other thing that we found is the tea pickers, even though their lives are really not very easy and they're actually paid very little, were so friendly and so welcoming and so hospitable. We kind of pull up and start kind of chatting and talking with them, and they really made that experience. And as we wrote on the blog, I think the piece that I wrote was like, the destination is everything, the destination is nothing. Because for us, one of the days we had our bikes and we had our destination in mind, but we really cared less about the lake. It was more about the journey going through the villages and the tea plantations, getting there. And you're invited into people's homes, and Bangladesh is one of those places where things just happen. If you leave yourself open, and it's a very safe country.
That was going to be my next question, actually.
It's a very safe country in that you can go to people's homes and not fear being either robbed or hurt or whatever. Their interest in you is genuine. Mm-hmm. And perhaps that's because tourism hasn't really developed and they haven't, unfortunately, developed like a sense of ripping people off. But it's really quite a safe country, even with the massive amounts of people. In addition to Sri Mongol, there's also an area in the south called the Chittagong Hill Tracks, CHT. And mm-hmm. that's an area that has a lot of ethnic diversity. It has, I think, maybe 13 or 14 ethnic groups. And several of them come from Burma or Myanmar, mm-hmm. as well as from different parts of India. So, I mean, we kind of joke that it's like Pan-Asia. We would take these photos of a group of girls, and some would look like South Asian, others would look Southeast Asian, other, you know.
Some would look like they came from Central Asia, some would look Tibetan, and some would look like they've come from halfway around the world.
Yeah.
It was really, truly fascinating. There's not, in many parts of Bangladesh, there's not a whole lot of diversity. But in that sort of eastern belt from Sri Mongol all the way south through the Chittagong Hill Tracks, particularly when you go into these small villages, it's just stunning the way the people look. They look like they come from every continent on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And you begin to wonder, how did these people get here? What's their story? And you can talk to them. So it's nice to actually go and hook up with an NGO that will do visits or treks through the hills. That's absolutely something in the Chittagong Hill Tracks that we would recommend people to do. It's also something worth doing in Sri Mongol, and talk to people in the villages and understand where they're from and understand a little bit of their background. And then it'll just get your interest piqued and you'll say, I need to understand where this, how these people came here and what created this place.
And the other thing with CHT or the Chittagong Hill Tracks is it's the one area of Bangladesh that is not dry. So rice wine is flowing. So
oh,
it's
dry,
kind of
dry.
Oh, dry in that way. Okay.
Dry as alcohol.
Yes.
Yeah, so. I was picturing Bangladesh as very tropical, so I, you had me confused there for a second. Okay.
Sorry, dry as in no alcohol.
Because of the Islamic influence. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. But the Chittagong Hill Tracks, the government has made an exception because of the local ethnic groups who are not Muslim. A lot of them are Buddhist. And so we kind of joke that that's the area where Bangladeshis go to party, because where rice wine flows and you can actually buy beer and a few other things. And we happened to be there at the time of the local New Year's, and the manager of our hotel kind of adopted us and took us around with his family. And the tradition is you have to visit at least 7 families, I think, in the course of a day.
We visited 11.
Yeah. And at each stop, you're basically inundated with food and endless amounts of rice wine. Yeah, it was an experience.
So to get back to one of your previous questions, for your listeners who are wondering, is Bangladesh safe?
Mm-hmm.
So absolutely. From the standpoint of people, it's safe. From the standpoint of being cheated, because there's very little tourism and the level of sophistication
of
touts and things like that, you're not going to experience, say, what you might in India, for example. Regarding transport,
less safe.
When you're crossing the country, particularly by bus, I will recommend train. And we took the train from the south in the Sundarbans from Khulna to Rajshahi. So someone who wants to experience the train, that's a lovely train journey. We also took a train from Dhaka to the east and the T area in Sri Mongol. That was also interesting, not quite as on time as the other one. We also took a number of buses across the country. And at that point, you begin to close your eyes and become a fatalist and say, come what may.
Yeah, like the buses in Bangladesh and the roads in Bangladesh start making the mountain cliff rides and Bolivia look very safe. Yeah. It's an experience. But that's why we highly recommend trying to take the train as much as possible.
When I was actually thinking of the safe question when you were talking about bicycling, because bicycling has the great advantage of not being disconnected from the people outside as you are in a car, for instance. But obviously, also, you're not protected from the traffic or whatever else is going on.
If you're in the countryside, you're not dealing with traffic. Mm-hmm. Obviously, cycling is perfectly safe, and you're riding through villages, and that's fine. When you're in the city, it's a different story. But at the same time, we did it. I had a camera on one hand, and on the other, handlebars, and I'm having trucks and buses come at me, and I'm thinking, there's an aspect of this, it's absolutely insane. And we've been traveling for 5 years. At the same time, it all sort of works out. With a place like Bangladesh, and when you're bicycling down a very busy street, and there's traffic coming from about 50 different directions. I think that's just what you do. You say, you know, this is the kind, I'm going to go with the flow. And when you go with the flow in a place like Bangladesh, things work.
Actually, yeah, it's when you stop and freak out, that's when things get dangerous. And one thing to keep in mind with Bangladesh is one of the main forms of transport in cities and in towns, it's still bicycle rickshaws. Mm-hmm. It's very much based on kind of slow transport, and bicycle rickshaws kind of weave in and out of the whole city.
What do you wish you had known before you went?
What it would feel like to be surrounded by 150 million people in the size of the state of Wisconsin.
Yeah. I noticed as you were saying terms like swarmed, I was writing down on a piece of paper. That sounded both exciting and, for someone shy like me, terrifying at the same time.
You tapped into exactly our experience, because I'm an introvert fundamentally and Audrey is an extrovert. And so we dealt with the constant deluge of people. And on one level, it was terrifically satisfying, because it was, this is why we came. We came for the people, and they were so open, and they had funny things to say, and they were full of questions and so curious. And you thought, you know, I could spend the rest of my life here and entertaining all these questions. And then after a few weeks of this, I said, I have to get out of here, because I need to decompress from this. And it was nothing against the people of Bangladesh, but mm-hmm. for an introvert, it can really be overwhelming. And so you really have to carve out time to get off the streets and take a nap.
And you mentioned connecting with people, which you had a wonderful opportunity to do. Most memorable person you met?
I was going to say about three different people pop into my head.
Who changed you?
I'd say the one person who perhaps changed me or opened my eyes was a university student who befriended me on one of the trains. Mm-hmm. And she came into our train compartment, was sitting across from me, and I could tell she was working up the courage to come and talk with me. And she eventually did, and it went from like working up the courage to talk to me to literally like holding my hand and almost like hugging me. And for someone who is rather shy, in the course of a few minutes when she worked up the courage, she kind of started offloading her whole life story, and she started asking me about my mother-in-law, and she started asking me about marriage, and she started telling me her own story about the boy she loved and her issues with her family. And it just kind of opened my eyes to kind of the reality of women in the country, mm-hmm. that here she was a university student, she was studying, and she was very bright, very resourceful. But when I asked her what she wanted to do after she studied, her response was, well, it depends on what my mother-in-law wants me to do. And you kind of realize that even though the country is progressing and there's a lot of women in universities, it's still a very traditional society where when young women do get married, it's the mother-in-law who basically decides their fate still. And it was kind of an eye-opener to me, because I was thinking, well, you're a university student, you know, you should be able to do whatever you want. But the reality is, for many women, the most important thing is to be married and to be part of society, and the mother-in-law and tradition is still what rules their lives. So it was kind of a optimistic as well as kind of sobering conversation.
Mm-hmm. Can I cap that with something optimistic?
Sure.
So the family that we did a homestay with in northwestern Bangladesh, a young woman who was just beginning university, her name was Asmani, and her hope was to be prime minister one day.
Okay.
And I really thought there is, in fact, a possibility of her being prime minister. And I said, I want you to give me your autograph, because I'm going to bet that someday you're prime minister. And I want to say that I met you and I stayed in your home all those years ago.
And we still have that autograph.
And we still have that autograph. And I'm hoping, I really am hoping, because I think she can do it, that she's going to get there someday.
You talk about coming across these things that make you realize that there's differences between the culture, as well as things that make you realize the similarities. When did you feel most at home, and when did you feel furthest from home?
I would say most at home was in the village, ironically. And I say ironically because, you know, when you look around, you're thinking, well, I'm in this rural environment, I'm in Bangladesh. There's so many things here that are different physically from home, but the feeling in the family was very similar, meaning once we arrived and, you know, we got over the formalities, it was very much kind of like coming home to our family in the United States, you know, in terms of the conversation topics and just the interactions with people. And the last night we were there, all the girls got together and made sure that they henna'd my hand, which you can kind of imagine a similar experience happening in the United States, not with henna, but like with makeup or something else. There was just kind of this very warm, family, homey feeling.
And furthest from home, the Toto, we're not in Kansas anymore moment.
I would say going out on the streets of Dhaka.
Mm-hmm.
Just in terms of the mayhem and the craziness and the fact that you cross the street and there's bicycle rickshaws coming at you, there's cars coming at you, there's auto rickshaws coming at you, and there's just people everywhere.
Yeah, maybe carving your way through Old Town Dhaka, which is the best place to go while you're in Dhaka, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
The people are fabulous. The food, as suspicious as it might look, is so great and it's cheap. And as you carve your way through that area and you make your way down to the river and the docks to an area called Shatterghat, which is where many people take boats and they go on the river. There at Shatterghat, the compression of people, the smells are just something completely otherworldly that would put most people, particularly those who are accustomed to sitting at home, feeling like they were on a different planet.
And I'm going to guess that's the highs and the lows of the smells.
That is the highs and the lows of the smells. Yes, very well and diplomatically said.
And you talked about food, and you're doing street food in there. What food stands out from...
Well, compared to India, Bangladesh doesn't have the same variety of food. But it's all kind of consistently good. So there's kind of a snack food called Shingara, which is... looks kind of similar to a samosa, but it's fatter and it is not as fried and it's filled with potatoes and vegetables, but it has just a really fantastic spice to it. And when you get it fresh, it just kind of melts in your mouth.
And it's made with like a flaky pastry, almost like a pie dough.
Yeah. Mm.
And you can get, in the best of cases, 24 of them for a dollar.
Okay.
So that's one. And then I'd say also just the sort of standard traditional shabzi, which is their vegetable curry.
Okay.
And then in terms of desserts, the doy, which is kind of the sweet curd. It's kind of like a crust on top. It's served in ceramic bowls. And when you can get that and it's fresh, that's also just to die for. And people would laugh because we would kind of obsess over these things and go to the restaurants where we knew they had the best doy. But yeah, when you can find a good doy, you just flock to it.
And you mentioned laughter. One thing that you saw that just made you laugh and say only in Bangladesh.
Every day.
Actually, I know what made me laugh. So Audrey and I stayed together pretty much the whole time. In some cases, out of defense for one another, because we were mobbed with people. But if one of us got away from the other by a few feet, invariably, the other would be surrounded by almost hundreds of people. And one of the times in Old Town Dhaka, I got maybe a few feet away from Audrey. I was taking photos. For whatever reason, people didn't notice me. The next thing I turn around, and she's surrounded by 150 people. And it's clear she doesn't know what to do with all of them.
Because they just start getting closer and closer. And again, it all comes from a good place. But when you start seeing all these people come at you, you're like, oh gosh, what am I going to do? For me, I think one of my favorite moments, I wasn't actually there, but Dan told me about it afterwards, was we were staying in the town of Bundaban, which is in the Chittagong Hill Tracks. And the hotel that we were staying at, I don't think had ever seen foreigners, or if they had, they'd seen very few. And the two boys or guys who were kind of the helpers in the guest house were just so excited by the fact that we were American. They were just over the top excited. And so one night, one of the guys knocks on the door and comes in, and he doesn't speak much English, so he kind of motions about spraying the place for mosquitoes. So Dan lets him spray. And then before the guy leaves, he comes up to Dan and gives him a hug goodnight. The guy's like up to his waist, you know? And so Dan's describing it. I couldn't stop laughing because I could picture it completely. Like, he's just such an innocent, like, sweet guy. I mean, he's not a boy, he's a man, you know. But yeah, he just kind of came over and gave Dan a hug goodnight before he left for the night. And that's just kind of the things that happen in Bangladesh, you know?
You know, I've stayed at the hotel I'm staying at now, I think roughly every month for the last year, and no one has ever done that.
Wait, you mean no one's come into your middle of the night and actually taken every excuse to come into your room, meaning 10 times during the course of the night, sprayed for bugs twice, made you cough and die by spraying, and then come back and hug you up to your waist? I mean, come on, tell me that doesn't happen every day.
I would have to say that it has not.
Yeah.
As we go to wind this down, before we get to my last two questions, what else would you want people to know before they go to Bangladesh?
It's not India.
It's not India. Okay. Yeah, that's an important thing because many people assume that it is.
Three things that struck you as different between India and Bangladesh.
The people. And it's not just the density, but just the interactions with people are different.
In what way?
I think partly because they don't have as many tourists or they don't have as many foreigners there. There's really almost like an innocence
an innocence. I think
it's
I think
genuine curiosity and innocence.
Now, in terms of managing expectations, I think number two is Bangladesh is not as colorful as India. Mm-hmm. It's primarily Muslim. I think that has an effect.
Sure.
India is much more diverse, and also Hinduism defines India. It expresses itself more colorfully. The last thing that I would add is understand this for people that have been to Calcutta in India. That's where Bangladeshis go to relax.
Just to provide context.
Just to provide you some perspective.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's just India is intense, but Bangladesh has an intensity all of its own. Yeah.
Huh, okay. That was helpful. Thank you. Okay. Last two questions. Finish this sentence. You really know you're in Bangladesh when what?
You've got 100 people surrounding you and taking photos of you with your cell phones.
You know you're really in Bangladesh when your hotel attendant hugs you.
And if you had to summarize Bangladesh in just three words, what three words would you use?
People, people, people.
I was going to say people, rivers, and I was going to say diversity because that's what surprised me.
Interesting.
Yeah, there is a diversity there. It's not as prevalent as in India, but if you look for it, there's some really fascinating groups in the north and the south and different areas throughout the country.
Well, Audrey and Daniel, it has again been a pleasure to have you on the show. Where can people read more about your travels?
At uncornedmarket.com.
And you can also find them on Twitter at umarket.com because Uncornered Market is too long, I'm guessing.
Uncornered Market is too long. And when we signed up for Twitter, we had no idea what we were doing. And we used it as a way to communicate with our family when we were in countries where there was internet censorship. And Twitter's grown quite a bit since 2006. So.
Well, you didn't say, as Daniel was talking about going down the road with his camera in one hand, he didn't mention that he was tweeting with the other, but I get the impression that is occasionally the case.
Actually,
can we actually speak to this? We completely forgot about this. This is actually an important point for travelers and travel bloggers. It's relatively easy to get your hand on a SIM card to put in your phone and to get data access across the country.
For like unlimited data access for $7 a month.
Oh my, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Reasonably and affordable. Okay.
It's not the fastest data access, but be available pretty much anywhere.
Interesting.
And that's actually the surprising thing with Bangladesh. There's so much about the country that, you know, we would think of as backwards or, you know, still developing. And yet it's much easier and faster and cheaper to get a data plan in Bangladesh than it is in the United States.
Well, and that would be one place where the population density would work in its favor instead of against it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Interesting.
And it's also, I love this fact as well, it's also a country that has banned plastic bags.
Hmm.
So you don't have the plastic bag trees or the plastic bag kind of trash you find everywhere in a lot of other countries, which, again, for a country that size and its population density is a pretty big feat. So there's a few things about Bangladesh that you're just kind of like, wow. How did they manage that, and what can we learn from it?
Interesting. Thank you so much, both of you, for coming on the show.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
In news of the community, I heard from Simon, who wrote, in 2009, I drove a London taxi from England to Kyrgyzstan as part of the London Bishkek rally. We crossed the whole of Kazakhstan, and it's difficult to comprehend the scale of this vast country, apparently the size of Western Europe. We were supposed to cross the Aral Sea area, but due to heavy rains, the, quote, roads, unquote, were impassable. Therefore, we had to take the long route around via Astana. Our maps had motorways marked, yet they were not built yet. Long days were had and wild camping overnight. A fascinating country, and being invited to the English ambassador's reception in Almaty was a great way to finish our time there. Thanks, Michael, for a great account of Kazakhstan. And obviously, Simon is commenting on episode 307, Travel to Kazakhstan. I also heard from John talking about Kazakhstan, who said, this was another one of those episodes where the enthusiasm of the guest blew me away. Michael most certainly has a passion for traveling, and his honest love for Kazakhstan was evident. I have already added it to my next places to visit list. Does Michael have a blog or somewhere to hear more about his travels? Looking forward to his next time on the show. No, at this time, Michael does not have a blog. Usually, if our guest does have a blog or a place to write one, we mention it at the end of the show, and usually the very first link in the show notes is a link to the guest blog as a way of thanking them for coming on the show. And I'm reminded by John, in terms of places that you have visited, I'm still looking for if people have gone to some place because they heard about it on the Amateur Traveler. I'm interested in hearing from you because I'm doing a series of posts about where people have traveled called Our Travels, because they were encouraged to do so because of the Amateur Traveler. With that, we're going to end this episode of the Amateur Traveler. I'm actually recording another podcast in 8 minutes, or This Week in Travel episode. If you have any comments, feel free to do what both John and Simon did and leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com, or drop me an email to host@amateurtraveler.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Chris2X. I'd like to thank you all for the 1.2 million downloads of this show, the Amateur Traveler Audio Edition, that happened in 2010. And that's not counting the other 300,000 downloads of both the video edition of this show as well as This Week in Travel. So 1.5 million podcast downloads total, and you're the ones who are doing it. So thank you very much. As always, thanks so much for listening.